Welcome back into You're the Cure right here with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Veritas Medical. Of course, Veritas Medical. Check out the website.com. All one word, veritasmedical.com. Our direct number to the clinic, 1-855-6-VERITAS. And let me say good morning once again to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Wade. Good morning, Melody.
Yes.
Hello.
Health coach Melody
soon
Wilkes.
Soon to be graduating.
Oh, yeah. She's going to be graduating soon, huh? Yeah, probably about a month.
Couple more weeks. Mid-September.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I look forward to that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I look forward to it because it's going to be eat right, eat healthy.
What do you mean, gonna be?
It already is. Actually, around our house, it's...
Oh, whatever.
It's over the top, Dr. Edwards.
That's why you got to go to Taco Bueno and get out of the house.
That's right. You've created a monster there, right?
I'm sorry.
No.
It's all good. Well, we have a good guest once again on the program. Of course, along the way, if anybody has any questions, they can always call in on the front line, on our back line, though. Front line, 745-5800. You can text in as well, 806-745-5800. But on our back line, we have Morley Robbins back with us.
Yes, Morley Robbins, part two today. We had Morley join us a few weeks ago prior to the arrival of my newest baby.
Oh, that's right.
Baby.
Congratulations
on
that.
Thank you. Had to take a couple of weeks off, but we're real excited to get Morley back on the show. And I encourage everybody to go listen to part one. That was a few weeks ago. It's on our website under radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
Morley's known as the magnesium man, but today we're going to talk about something besides magnesium.
We are.
And that being iron. As Morley mentioned in the show last time, you know, his stage name is Magnesium Man. His website's gotmag.org. His Facebook group is called the Magnesium Advocacy Group. Yet he spends all his time now researching and talking about iron and the detrimental effects of iron. So that's going to be our topic of our conversation today. But I want to frame the conversation again. I kind of alluded to this last time on part one. But I want to remind everybody that pre-World War II, we were one of the healthiest people groups in the world. Americans were. And post-World War II, it's been nothing but downhill. Now we're the sickest of the industrialized countries. We are the sickest. Just about any disease category you look at, you know, overall number of chronic diseases, we lead the pack. Life expectancy, we're the worst. We die youngest. Even infant mortality, we're the worst. More of our babies die. Number of children with a chronic disease, it's approaching 50%. It's just been this dramatic uptick. More than a tick, it's just been this tidal wave of disease that's overcome our nation, really, post-World War II. So everyone needs to remember that. We used to be healthy, now we're super sick. The Pima Indians are a great example. They're Native Americans in southeast Arizona. In pre-World War II, they had zero cases of type 2 diabetes in the whole tribe, and now 50% of their tribe is diabetic. And the point I'm trying to make here is we can't just blame our genes anymore. That's what everyone used to want to do, just, oh, it's my genes. My dad had diabetes and heart attack, and my mom had breast cancer, so I'm going to. There's nothing I can do about it, so I'll just eat and live however, you know, I please. It's not the genes. Genes can't change that fast from World War II until now. It's the diet and it's the lifestyle, and there's particular things about that diet and lifestyle. And studies show this. 95% of cancer, diet and lifestyle related, a study out of the Journal of Pharmacology a couple years ago. 80%+ of cardiovascular disease, the number one killer in America. It's 85%, it's diet and lifestyle. I mean, it's so glaringly obvious, but no one's talking about it. We're not taught this in med school. And really what we're taught in med school is what I call option two. I came out of med school thinking there were only two options when it came to diseases. Option one, suffer from whatever ailment, symptom, disease you had. Or option two, take a pharmaceutical or a surgery, chemo, radiation, whatever. But those were the tools I had in my toolbox to give a pharmaceutical to treat that symptom. And that's it. Option one, option two, suffer or take a drug to treat a symptom. What I didn't even realize was there was this option three, which is fix it. And a great analogy is my wife's probably said this 500 times on the show, but I'll say it one more time for new listeners. My wife had a leaky tire one day on her Suburban, and I would just run by the filling station, fill it up with air. And it was a real slow leak, so that would work for a few days, but by the fourth or fifth day, it had gotten flat enough to need more air, so I'd go fill it up again. And I just kept doing this over and over and over. So the options there, we could have just suffered and not filled it up at all and just ran around on a flat tire and ruined the rim and a bunch of other bad stuff. So we didn't pick option one of suffer on that flat tire. We filled it up with air. But every 5 days, we had to go back and fill it up some more. And obviously, option three would be to fix it, pull the tire off, fix the hole, be done with it, and go on about your business. The problem with option two, just like on the vehicle, if you just fill that tire up every 5 days, well, as it's slowly leaking out air, that's hard for that tire. The wear and tear, the life expectancy of that tire is going to go down. You're going to increase the likelihood of a blowout. You're going to probably ruin or decrease your life expectancy of your shocks, your struts. Your alignment's going to get off. It's going to stress out the other three tires. It's just bad for the vehicle. So if you just stay in that world of option two, fill it up every 5 days, there are unintended consequences of that. Yeah, you can get where you need to go, get to the grocery store, get the kids where they need to go. But there's these unintended consequences that aren't happening maybe right then that you can see, but down the road, that blowout's going to happen or the alignment's off or whatever, these unintended consequences. It's the exact same thing with pharmaceutical-based medicine, which we talked about in the part one in medical school. We are basically taught how to be glorified pharmacologists. We learn how to match symptoms to a label. We call it a disease, and then there's a drug that goes to every disease, whether that be reflux or hypertension or eczema or diabetes or whatever. And then that's it. You get your symptoms labeled, then there's a drug that goes to it. You write the prescription. You're out the door, 7-minute visits, 40 patients a day. You make plenty of money doing that. But the patients never get well. The disease, quote-unquote, stays around forever. That slow leak in the tire is always going to be there. And that works out real good for the guy at the filling station who's charging 25 cents for every time you fill up your tire. The guy selling the air is making out like a bandit.
That's a great analogy, actually. Yeah. It really is when you think about it.
And now, and what 75 years of doing this has led us to those statistics I just mentioned. We're the sickest country in the world, of the industrialized world, and even of the non-industrialized. We're behind the pack in from some of these countries, like Croatia even. I think we're behind them in health outcomes. And we're spending the most money, and we're going bankrupt. I mean, the whole thing's just crazy. If we were a professional sports team or a Fortune 500 company, we'd be fired. The board of directors would be fired. Everybody would be fired because our outcomes are awful, and we're spending all this money. So that's what I want to just remind everyone, that's the backdrop here that we're talking today, the frame that I want to frame this conversation with Morley, because what Morley's teaching is about getting down to the very, very, very root cause of stuff. And just to refresh everyone's memory from part one, we specifically were talking about enzymes. There's over 9,000 enzymes in the body, and think of enzymes as the keys that turn on your ignition of your car. Enzymes run the body. There's chemicals, pathways, chemical reactions that are firing off left and right, you know, thousands of them every second in every cell. Well, these chemical reactions go, that they actually are able to proceed forward because of enzymes. Enzymes initiate and process these chemical reactions through, but it's the minerals that trigger the enzymes. You've got to have the minerals. The minerals are the key that turns those enzymes on. So it's all about enzymes. And like I said, over 9,000 enzymes in the body, 3,751 of those enzymes are dependent upon a key called magnesium. Minerals run these enzymes. Magnesium's the biggest of all the minerals. Morley described it as a conductor of the symphony last time. So we really keyed on magnesium because it runs these enzymes and it also makes our energy. Magnesium, ATP, we learned last time. ATP is our energy molecule, but it's got to have magnesium tagged onto it for it to actually function. And then we learned there's another mineral called iron that is actually the initiator of inflammation. We talk about inflammation all the time on the show, but if you look in the biochemical pathway, when you trace it all the way back to the very first step in the recipe of inflammation, that first trigger that says go inflammation, it's initiated by iron. Iron pulls the trigger on that inflammatory cascade. So iron turns out to be kind of the bad guy. Iron battles magnesium and actually eats it for lunch, I think is what Morley said last time. Iron causes magnesium to just pour out of the cell. It pushes the magnesium out of our cell. So iron is not a good thing unless it's properly escorted around the body with proper transport proteins we talked about last time. It's kind of like letting my 4-year-old, you know, run into school. On the first day of school, my 4-year-old, this was his first time in school, pre-K, he bails out of the car and starts running towards the front door, and I'm kind of hollering at him, "Hey, tell, just a minute, you know, wait up." "Oh, Dad, it's all right. I know where I'm going." He didn't have a clue where he was going. He'd never been into that school. He needed an escort. He would have been crazy in there, wild and crazy, and caused all kinds of havoc probably. So iron has to be properly escorted around the body. And when it's not, and when there's too much of it, and it overwhelms the escort system, there's dramatic effects. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Magnesium is very important. Iron is kind of the big bad guy. But everyone kind of thinks they're iron deficient. We learned last time iron's been fortified into our food, even though it's a carcinogen, which Morley defined last time as a carcinogen has to do all three: initiate, promote, and progress cancer. And iron does all three of those. And there's 8 forms of iron that have been added to our food supply since the 1940s. All 8 of those have been classified as a carcinogen. So after our show last time, I was talking with Morley about our next show. I want to maybe talk about all these different diseases: heart disease, osteoporosis, reflux, hypertension, nosebleeds even. And show and talk about and explain to the listeners how all these different enzymes deficiencies cause all these diseases. But he said, well, maybe we ought to talk about iron first. Since iron is the thing that disrupts so many of these biochemical pathways, we've got to convince people first that iron's bad and that there's maybe no such thing as anemia, which I know that sounds crazy. But that's what we need to really get into today, is really talk about, can we be iron deficient really on this planet? Morley mentioned last time it's the number one most prolific mineral on the whole planet, composition-wise of the Earth. So we want to really talk about iron today, and then in future shows we can maybe get more into different diseases and enzyme pathways. But Morley, I know that was a really long intro, but I wanted to sort of really set the stage, because what we're going to talk about today is going to kind of really go against the grain or the common thinking of most people, that they need to take a multivitamin with iron or supplement with iron or eat more iron. I'm weak, I'm low energy, give me more iron. And we're going to talk about maybe that's not true. But our listeners are pretty well versed in that we talk about the exact opposite on this show of what conventional thinking often says. So, Morley, I don't know if my intro evoked any thoughts in you. If not, let's just move into when did you start? Yeah, go ahead.
They did. No, that was an amazing opening volley. You've got me all stirred up now.
Okay, good.
First,
I was trying.
First of all. No, you did a great job. I want to find a way to clone you, Ben. That's the first thing I want to do. Secondly, I'm absolutely going to steal your analogy with your wife's car tire, because that's a classic. And I loved Melody's response to "There may not be anemia." What? that's priceless. And so let me key off of this whole issue, because you are using the Second World War as a pivot point. And let me drill down on this issue and give the listeners some facts that I think might surprise them. They certainly surprised me as I was doing my research over the weekend. And, of course, I had the opportunity to share some of it with you, and you were like, wow, we do need to talk about this. So I appreciate your taking the time. But there's a lot of confusion, as you've intimated in your comments, about iron and anemia, and we talked about magnesium, but the mineral that very rarely ever gets any visibility is the mineral copper. Now, copper has been on this planet, or it's been used notably since 8,000 BC. That's the earliest record of when copper was being used. And the Iron Age didn't come on the scene until about 2000 BC. So for 6,000 years, our ancestors, our ancient ancestors, used this prized metal, copper. And then, of course, everything changed a couple, 4,000 years ago with the advent of the Iron Age. But I want to fast forward and bring the listeners up to the period of 1923 to 1940, before the Second World War, and the great researchers both in Germany, in England, and in the United States, were in a massive search to find out how blood worked and what were the metals that were essential to make blood work. And I'm talking about people like Otto Warburg, who got a Nobel Prize in 1931 for discovering what's called the respiratory enzyme. It's one of the most important enzymes in the body, and he certainly deserved his recognition. There's a guy named Hans Krebs. People may have heard of the Krebs cycle. He, too, won a Nobel Prize, but he was working with this guy named Warburg over in Berlin, and he, too, was obsessed with copper and iron. There was a noted physician. He started out in Cambridge and eventually ended up at the University of Wisconsin. His name was LVM. It's a Dutch name. It would take me an hour to explain how to spell it. But the initials LVM work. And he had a lot of gifted people at the University of Wisconsin, most notably Hart and Schultz. And all these folks are in a massive hunt to figure out how blood works. And why is this so important? Because they were worried about anemia. And what people have to understand is anemia, back in the day, from like 1860 to 1972, was always measured with respect to the protein hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is the protein that delivers oxygen to the cell so that energy can be made. It's a really big deal. It's the supply train for delivering oxygen. And that's the measurement. That was the yardstick that was used to measure anemia for over 100 years, 1860 to 1972. And anemia technically means not in the blood. It's a Latin phrase, anemia. It's not in the blood. And what it meant was that the hemoglobin level was too low in the blood. Everybody knew that for over 100 years. And then in 1972, a British hematology team, headed up by Dr. Jacobs, published an article in the British Medical Journal on ferritin. Ferritin is a storage protein. It stores iron inside the cell. And so in 1972, the spotlight flipped from hemoglobin, which accounts for 70% of the iron in the human body is found in hemoglobin, and less than 10% of iron is found in ferritin. That's a big deal, less than 10%. I've seen that the number is as low as 1% of iron is found in ferritin. Yet it is now regarded as the standard of measure for iron status, which is the most laughable thing on the planet. But let me go back to these researchers. In 1923 to 1940, they were hot on the trail of what's working. What's interesting is that Warburg gets his Nobel Prize in 1931 for this respiratory enzyme. He thought that this respiratory enzyme ran on iron. That's what I think a lot of doctors think. Turns out that complex 4 has two copper centers, and then they have what are called heme A and heme A3. Well, heme is a shortened version of the phrase cytochrome A and cytochrome A3, and it turns out neither of those cytochromes can be made without copper. So the whole complex 4 is totally dependent on copper. Why is that important? Because it's complex 4 that uses the oxygen so that ATP can be released, so that it can be made for energy. And so we have a difference between hemoglobin supplying oxygen and copper inside the complex 4 using oxygen. It's a big difference between supply and use. The other thing I want to point out is that in 1935, a Dr. Sachs, who was also working with LVM, profiled blood in normal men and normal women. And the copper levels in 1935 are actually higher than they are today. But what shocked me was to learn that the iron levels in 1935 in healthy men and women were 50% of what they are today. 50% lower.
Wow.
80-some years ago. And then in 1939, Dr. Schultz, also part of this noted team at the University of Wisconsin, they were in the Department of Agricultural Chemistry. These guys were geniuses. And Dr. Schultz revealed that in a state of iron deficiency, this complex 4 activity actually increases. Wow. So actually complex 4 gets, it turns out that complex 4 gets hosed and compromised when there's too much iron. And in fact, depending upon who you want to believe, the loss of energy production can be 40%, 60%, 80%, and as high as 98%. So iron is not necessarily the good guy. So let's come back to this issue of supply and use. And let me key off of your reference point, Ben, of the Second World War. I was never in the military. I'm not a gaga military guy, but sometimes it's very powerful to use these images to really drive home the point. So I hope I don't offend the listeners by some of the examples I'm going to use. But a lot of people have probably seen the HBO series Band of Brothers. And it was profiling a group of soldiers who were a part of the D-Day invasion. They were part of the paratroop invasion, the 15,000 men that were deployed into France. and that was a big deal. I mean, and the thing is, what people don't really appreciate was the supplies and logistics that had to take place in order to make that invasion possible. Think of the hundreds of thousands of men that were camped in Portsmouth, England, prior to the war, for 2 years prior to the war, getting ready for this invasion, and Major General Henry Saylor, S-A-Y-L-E-R, was in charge of all of those logistics, making sure that all the supplies, tanks, trucks, gasoline, and bullets made it from Portsmouth, England, to Normandy Beach. It was a big deal. But who in the world has ever heard of Henry Saylor? He's a famous general, but, of course, he was in charge of logistics and supply. But who do we know about? We know about Major Dick Winters. He was part of that parachute invasion. He was a lieutenant at the time. And his commanding officer was blown out of the sky by German artillery. And so suddenly Dick Winters lands in St. Mary Glace. He didn't even have a rifle. You know, here's a guy who's supposed to be in the battle. He ends up, because of what happened, his plane gets shot. They have crash land. It's a miracle that he survived. He doesn't even have a rifle. He's in the 101st Airborne, and he ends up working with guys in the 82nd Airborne to start the war. And this guy is having to think really fast, and for anyone who's watched the show, they have an idea of just how significant Dick Winters was, because he's the guy that took out one of the major howitzers that was pummeling the troops trying to land Normandy. He had 13 men with him. He didn't even have a rifle, for heaven's sakes. And they took out a group of 50 German soldiers, destroyed the 105-millimeter guns, and oh, by the way, found a map that had all of the gun displacements by the Germans up and down Normandy. It's a major deal. That one act is what enabled the invasion to be the success that it was. And so why do I use this expanded analogy? Well, Major General Saylor was in charge of supply. He was making sure that the bullets were there. Major Dick Winters was using bullets to make something happen. He caused something to happen. I was so impressed by Major Dick Winters. This was back in 2001 when I watched the show. I wrote him an email to thank him for his service and for allowing me to sleep at night. And to give you an idea of what a true hero he was, he wrote me back. And he thanked me for taking the time to acknowledge his service. The guy was a class act. He just passed away a few years ago. But the point is, in the military, supply is really important. And I'm sure that General Eisenhower knew that 73,000 men had been deployed on D-Day. And I'm sure that General Eisenhower also knew that there were thousands more soldiers back in Portsmouth, England. But do you think that the General Eisenhower knew that there were some soldiers on leave at Burt's Pub in Portstown? Do you really think he cared about the soldiers that were on leave in Portstown? So why do I use that analogy? Because what we've got is the soldiers on the front line are copper because they're using oxygen. And oxygen in the hands of copper is a very important component of human physiology. Oxygen in the hands of iron is very destructive. And so it's really important to know how many troops are able to work with that oxygen. It's important to know, it's important to know that there are a bunch of troops back at the base camp in Portsmouth. You want to know, there's a lot of turnover taking place on Normandy Beach. But you want to know how many troops are available for the second and third and fourth wave. But do you really care about the number of troops that are in the pubs? And the reason why I bring up that analogy is the troops back at Fort Sedgwick in Portsmouth, that's hemoglobin. You got to know how much hemoglobin you've got. The guys on leave in Burt's Pub, that's ferritin. It's offline. Do we really care about that at all, to be honest? And what has happened in the course of our lifetime since 1972 is all distortion about iron versus copper, and what was the conclusion of these greats, the Dr. Warburg, Dr. Krebs, Dr. LVM, Dr. Schultz, Dr. Hart. They were all acknowledging that you must have both copper and iron. They are essential. There's 60 times more iron in the human body than copper. But the iron, as you were pointing out, Ben, iron needs to be chaperoned. It needs to be managed. It is like a four-year-old, just like your son. And what has been lost on practitioners the world over and their patients is that iron is a highly destructive mineral when it's not being chaperoned. And it takes copper to make sure that it's being properly chaperoned. And every facet of blood metabolism, from soup to nuts, every facet of blood metabolism is dependent on both copper and iron, and it's a ventriloquist act. And it turns out that iron is the dummy. And so what's happened in the modern era is we've lost sight of hemoglobin, which is it's a supply train. We got to know how much iron is in supply, but what has been completely obscured and totally lost is the troops that are actually working with the oxygen, and that's complex four. And what's amazing is there is no unit of measurement for complex four in the human body. I've tried for days on end to find it. It doesn't exist. And as we discussed in the class the other day, there really isn't a good unit of measurement for how much energy is being produced in the human body. We can measure rust, we can measure inflammation, we can measure disease all day long, but we don't have any good way to measure energy. And that's really what the body is choosing between. Am I going to make energy or am I going to make exhaust? then what you want to be able to do is take that oxygen in the mitochondria and flip it so that it becomes water, which is what releases the energy molecule inside the mitochondria. It's the most important function in the human body. Because if you don't have energy, then you invite disease. And so we have this intense scrutiny about the supply side, but we've even lost sight of the supply side. Now we're just focusing on the storage of iron. We're not even aware of the supply side, and we have no knowledge about the active side, the use side of oxygen. And that, I think, is a great tragedy for medicine, and I think it creates all sorts of confusion for people because they've been trained, like circus bears, to believe that if they're low in energy, they need more iron, when in fact the research is very clear you're going to get between 40 to 98% loss of energy. It's very clear in the research that iron sucks energy out of the mitochondria. But yet everything has been twisted and turned upside down on its head. And so I think it's important for the listeners to understand where the deception actually took place and how it has gotten completely out of control by the modern diagnostic methods, looking at serum ferritin, which has no relationship to intracellular ferritin, which is inside the cell. So I'm going to stop at this point because I think people are probably like gasping for air trying to figure out, wow, I had no idea. But I'll pause here and let you jump in and say, what's your reaction and what are your questions relative to what I've just shared?
Morley, my brain's on fire and smoke's coming out of my ears. That's my reaction. I'm kidding. That was awesome. And I want to summarize it a little more in layman's terms. As soon as we come back, we're up against a break. But let's everybody digest this for a couple minutes. We'll be right back and talk more about this cellular respiration and energy production.
All right, we'll get right back into it. Of course, Morley Robbins, our guest this morning right here on You're the Cure.
Well, I just want to summarize real quick what this great explanation Morley just laid out to us. Specifically when he was talking about back in the 1930s and Dr. Warburg and the Nobel Prize for the respiratory enzyme, we're not talking about respiration like you're breathing, your lungs and breathing in. We're talking about at the cellular level. These cells do a process we call respiration, but basically it's taking oxygen from what you breathed in that's transported around the blood and then delivered to the cell. The cell's got to take that oxygen and put it through some chemical steps, chemical pathways that actually turn it into water. But during that process of turning oxygen into water, you make energy called ATP, which we learned last week. You got to have magnesium hooked to that ATP for it to actually be energy you can use. So that's what we're talking about with respiration. It's inside the cell, specifically inside the mitochondria in your cell, where this whole process happens, where you're moving oxygen through into water and making energy. And complex 4 is one of those steps along the way to make this energy. And copper has to be there for this whole process to function properly. And if it's not, then you're not making energy, you're making exhaust. And if there's too much iron in the cell, in the mitochondria, same thing. It's messing this whole process up. And you're going to make exhaust instead of energy and actually deplete yourself of energy, as Morley just talked about, when you take iron in this state. When you think you need more iron because your energy is low and you take more, you actually deplete energetically in this, at the cell and the mitochondria. You'll make less energy. So that's what we're talking about in the cell, making energy versus making exhaust. Copper is very important. And iron has its place, but too much iron and unregulated iron, unchaperoned iron, actually drives inflammation and creates more exhaust. So that's a little summary, Morley. We were just talking about, before the break also, ferritin, which is, we're kind of taught in school, it's a storage form of iron that floats around in the blood. And what you were just explaining was the ferritin level in the blood does not translate or correlate or equal the ferritin level inside the cell. Two different things. So it's really almost pointless to measure that ferritin or storage iron in the blood. A lot of doctors are. And we can talk about what that might mean when it's too high or too low. In fact, I think we should just start right there, because I think a lot of doctors are measuring that ferritin now, because it has been associated, high ferritin has been associated with inflammation and disease. So they measure that, but still the on your normal, quote-unquote normal lab range, when at your doctor's office, I think the normal range, most labs like Quest and LabCorp, you know, it's up to like 200 or something like that, 180. So talk a little bit about the ferritin in the blood versus ferritin inside the cell, and maybe the appearance of that ferritin being low or high, what that means.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, as you say, iron is really important. But what I'm coming to realize is that it's more of a structural mineral than it is a catalytic mineral. And I think people, it's holding on to oxygen. I get that. But it doesn't know what to do with it, and it's copper that's actually using it. What's important about the ferritin?
Let me just interject more, because it's a great analogy you gave us during the conference. Iron, structural, like you just said, think of a building. You know, the iron beams that hold up a building, versus catalytic. That'd be your copper wires running through that building that conduct the electricity all through your building, so you can have lights. Copper is more catalytic. Iron is more structural. So go ahead.
Yeah, and so the ferritin molecule inside the cell, it's an important depot for iron, because the iron, of course, is used to make heme and gets involved in what are called iron sulfur clusters and things like that. But again, it's more of a structural component. And so that group back in 1972 was trying to say that there's a relationship between iron inside the cell and the ferritin inside the cell, and ferritin in the serum. Well, the world's authority on ferritin is a British researcher. His name is Sir Douglas Kell. He's at the University of Manchester. I've had a chance to talk with him several months ago, and asked him point blank, I said, Dr. Kell, what's the ideal level of ferritin in the human body? And he said, in the serum of the human body, he said zero. And I looked at him, I was on Skype, and I thought he was kidding at first. Then I realized he wasn't. He's my age, he's 64, very affable, brilliant man. He's been knighted recently in 2014. And he said, Morley, I want to make sure you understand this. He said, iron in the serum is from liver pathophysiology. He said, so that when the liver starts to break down from too much iron, because that's what causes things to break down, is too much iron, he said, these liver cells called hepatocytes break apart, and they release the proteins that are inside the cell. And he said, so the ferritin is expressing into the blood at that point. But his contention is that the iron has been released from those ferritin molecules. And what people don't realize is that each molecule of ferritin inside the cell can hold 4,500 atoms of iron. It's a big deal. And what's important is, it isn't just that it's this metal, it's what it represents. The iron atom has what are called four unpaired electrons. In nature, unpaired electrons are very volatile. So one atom of iron has four unpaired electrons. One molecule of ferritin has 10,000 unpaired electrons. And what happens, to your point about what happens when it gets low, when the serum ferritin starts to get low, it means that the ferritin is becoming denatured. It's losing its natural structure. And it's going into lockdown mode, and more iron is being stored in it, and it has 100,000 unpaired electrons. 100,000 unpaired electrons is a very bad thing, especially inside the body. And so when serum ferritin starts to go south, starts to get into the teens or single digits, what doctors have been trained to believe is that means that iron stores are low. That's a lie. It means that the iron has been locked away and it's not as accessible because of a lack of copper. It turns out that inside the cell, that intracellular ferritin, in order to get iron into ferritin and in order to get iron out of ferritin, requires bioavailable copper. Ding, ding, ding. So it turns out that the very storage protein for iron is copper dependent. Most people don't know that. Certainly most practitioners don't know that. And so when it starts to get too low, it means that it's been locked away and it's not available for optimal use. It's not that you have too little iron, you have too little usable iron. Then the flip side, when it starts to get over 100, 150 for a woman, 300 for a man, when it starts to get into the high hundreds and thousands, well, that is a sign of absolute iron overload, and it means that the liver is absolutely overwhelmed with iron. And it's so overwhelmed, it's just, it's expressing it into the blood, because it's a signal that the body has lost its natural mechanism to regulate that protein. And so it turns out that either too little ferritin or too much ferritin are both signs of iron overload. And that's part of the challenge, is to realize that it's all about making the iron usable. Yeah. And so what makes iron usable is copper, especially when it's complexed inside an important protein in the blood, and that's what the greats were focusing on. What is the amount of copper that's needed to make iron usable? And over the course of 90 years, all of that breakthrough scientific research has been lost, and now we're dumbed down to the point of your four-year-old thinking that if I'm tired, I need more iron. And it's the exact opposite. That's where the breakdown has taken place in society, but also in the practitioners that we rely on for our well-being.
Yeah. Well, and I can tell you, I don't believe I can recall a single time in medical school, 3 years of residency, or any continuing education after residency, the word copper even being mentioned. I really don't recall that at all, that I was taught anything about copper. So it's interesting that pre-1972, when people were anemic, the thought was copper deficiency. Post-1972, what you're saying is it all got switched to iron and no one even thinks about copper anymore.
Exactly. And up what they understood by 1940 was that the production of hemoglobin was absolutely copper dependent.
Okay.
Across five different, there are five different reasons why copper is essential to make hemoglobin. And oh yes, hemoglobin does have iron in it, but again, it's structural. Yeah. It's not catalytic.
Well, and the thing that hit me this weekend when you shared that article from 1935 or 36.
35.
Yeah, 1935.
35. Yeah.
When in that figure one or two, when he went through and showed the average levels or amounts of iron in the blood of these healthy men and women. And you said it earlier, twice as much iron today in 2017 in all of our blood than back in the early part of the 1900s in healthy people. Half as much iron. So, I mean, just that alone makes gotta cause you to raise your eyebrows and wonder, how could anyone be iron deficient?
Right. And the thing is, the hemoglobin levels back then, back in 1935, were normal. They had half as much iron, but hemoglobin was absolutely normal. Again, it was keying off of the copper. That's the part that's been lost, is that hemoglobin needs copper to be made. And it's essential for the physiology of the human body, is in order to drive energy, you got to have hemoglobin.
Yeah.
Why? Because hemoglobin's the supply train bringing the oxygen.
Yep.
So it's like, yeah, you got to have both. My point is not to denigrate iron, but to get people to realize that it is a ventriloquist act, and iron is the dummy, and we need more spotlight on this bioavailable copper. That's really the catalytic agent giving us the energy that allows us to have the vitality that we want in life.
Yeah, and it's one thing to not have the available copper in maybe a low iron level or a 1930 level of iron, but it's another thing to have to not have copper available and have excess iron, which we all do. It was added to the food, and we've all been eating and being birthed from mothers right. who have too much iron. Everybody just has too much iron, period. So now you've got this double-edged sort of too much iron in everyone's tissues and at the same time not enough bioavailable copper. What we're talking about there, listeners, bioavailable, you may have the copper in the body, but kind of like with iron, it's got to be escorted. It's got to be hooked up to a transport protein called ceruloplasm in order to be available to work in the body. Copper that's unbound, that's not hooked up to this protein, that's just floating around free, can't be used. So it's got to be connected to this protein. Well, that protein is made in the liver, and magnesium is needed to make that protein. And when you're under stress, the liver can't do that. So we always talk about stress, and here's exactly biochemically why stress matters. When you're stressed, your mag is down, you can't make the transport protein for copper. Now copper's not available to do its job in the cell to make the energy. And then now you've got iron overloaded, causing all this free radical damage and inflammation because there's not enough copper there to help regulate it, and it all comes together beautifully or ugly, depending on which perspective you have. But it all starts to make sense once you drill down into the biochemistry, like Morley obviously has done so well.
And just to extend the war analogy one more step, you refer to ceruloplasmin as a transport protein. And that's what a lot of the literature wants us to believe, is that it's just a taxi. You know, a taxi can hold, you know, four or five people, depending upon how big it is. Well, it turns out that ceruloplasmin is actually a tank. And when you're in a pitched battle inside the human body where there's a fight over oxygen all day long, that's really where the battleground is. It's right out of Braveheart. Trust me, you don't want to be in a taxi. You want to be in a tank. And to operate a tank, you need to have four soldiers, and they all have a different job inside that tank. Well, it turns out that the tank called ceruloplasm has eight soldiers inside. It has eight copper atoms. And what people need to understand is this protein that we're talking about is profoundly important inside the body, and it plays a very pivotal role in ensuring that other enzymes get working properly. And it's this energy of the copper inside this tank that has a very significant influence over the metabolism of the body. But the point is, you gotta have a vehicle, but it's gotta be a tough vehicle to have impact inside the body.
Okay. Well, in future shows, we'll go into some of the details of when you don't have that tank, what are some of the enzymes mm-hmm. that don't work and manifest as disease and all that. But one point I want to make before we've got about 5 minutes left until the end of the show, unfortunately, but I think the listeners are getting the message here that too much iron that's unchaperoned is not good. You've got to have copper to make energy. So people might be thinking, well, let's run to the health food store and buy a supplement that has copper in it, and let's just take copper every day. But in fact, that's probably not what you want to do. In fact, almost definitively not what you want to do. Can you explain, just touch in 5 minutes if you can, on why don't you just run out and take copper? How do you address with your clients who appear to be in bad shape as far as they don't have enough available copper inside the cell to do the job? What do you do about it besides supplement?
The copper that's available in most supplements is not bioavailable. Mother Nature has a way of working through plants and animals to make the copper usable inside humans. What we use is bee pollen, and there's the golden color of bee pollen that's copper there that's providing the B vitamins in that bee pollen. That's a very bioavailable form of copper. A second form is in whole food vitamin C. And I'm sure in a future show we'll talk about the distinction between ascorbic acid versus whole food vitamin C. But the whole food vitamin C that you can get in some supplements is a much more bioavailable form of copper because it's complexed in another enzyme, but it's very usable. And then the third form of copper that we recommend for our clients is beef liver. And what I would encourage people, your listeners, is to track down Holy Cow Beef. They have an amazing product called Primal Beef, and it's a mixture of ground beef. It's 70% ground beef, 15% ground liver, and 15% ground heart, which the organ meats are the ones that have all of the copper in them. And it's a wonderful source of bioavailable copper. But beef liver or this organic product, the Primal Beef that is sold at Holy Cow Beef, it's amazing, and it's very bioavailable. Don't run to the nearest GNC or your nearest health food store and grab a copper sulfate. It's not going to work. It doesn't have the same properties. So you've got to use ones that Mother Nature has allowed to be properly designed and are then usable inside the body.
Okay. And I may add to that that trying to avoid too much iron, obviously you don't want to take a grocery store brand multivitamin or really any multivitamin that has iron in it. You don't need supplemental iron. And then the foods that are fortified with iron are primarily your grains. At Veritas, historically, have had people get off grains just because of the glycemic load that it creates, that insulin spike, and drives all that inflammation that we thought mainly through the sugar. But now it's this iron fortification in the grains. So decrease or eliminate grains, or if you're going to eat them, eat ancient grains, non-fortified grains. And then get your whole food vitamin C through various, a lot of the bright vegetables, bell peppers, the citrus fruits, lime, lemon, oranges. And like Morley said, there are some supplements with whole food vitamin C, but flip your labels over and read on it. If it says ascorbic acid or ascorbate, that's not whole food vitamin C. We'll talk about that more in an upcoming show. But what Morley just explained was basically you eat this stuff. Everyone used to eat organ meats, eat your liver, once a week. No one does that anymore. So getting back to an ancestral type of diet and an eating plan that our great-grandparents used to do and our ancient ancestors used to do before there was all this disease. So that was a lot today, Morley. It was really, really good. I think we really laid a good foundation for why it's just not this automatic answer of take iron if you have low energy. And low energy is a common denominator among all Western disease, from cancer to heart disease. It's low energy at the cellular level. And we'll talk about that more in a coming show as we'll start relating all these different diseases from heart disease and cancer and osteoporosis and everything else exactly to these minerals. So stay tuned for future shows and more education. Morley, we sure appreciate you being here today and educating us with all your insightful wisdom.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity. I love dancing on mines, and this is just a great way to do it. And I appreciate the exchange that we can have about these critical issues.
Okay. Well, we look forward. Until next time, have a great week.
You as well. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call, Morley. Again, Dr. Ben Edwards, you're the cure. Of course, check it out. We'll be back next Monday. Or no, we won't. Next Monday we'll be off because it's Labor Day.
All right.
Hey!
There we go.
So, well, 2 weeks.
Go have some more baby time.
I was going to say, your wife's already had Labor Day.
Yeah.
Yes, she has. It was a heck of labor. Well, remind me next show to talk about that a little bit. We learned a lot through our midwife in relationship to iron, too, when you don't cut that cord right away. But I know we're out of time today, but remind me, this fascinating stuff we learned about with these babies and iron and breast milk and the lack of iron in the breast milk and stuff. But
wow.
It was a great, great day, our day of delivery, a beautiful, healthy baby girl. I'm happy to have her.
Yeah. Well, congratulations once again.
Thank you.
We'll see you back here in a couple of weeks right here on You're the Cure, right here on AM 580. Stick around now, though. Unconfused coming up next right here on AM 580.